From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for March 25th, 2022. Your Milwaukee Bucks are on the road this coming week, and the Brewers continue Cactus League action in Arizona. And it's National Introverts Day. Getting noticed, isn't that the last thing they want? Hey, here's a quick way to pick up $5 million. Just snitch on the Russian oligarchs that are hiding their wealth, especially their multi-million dollar yachts. Of course, you have to weigh the money against the old saying, snitches get stitches. But for $5 million, a few stitches might be worth it. Because of the supply chain issues, etc., there are all kinds of shortages across the planet. Here's an interesting solution to one of them. There's a paper shortage in Sri Lanka, and the government's remedy is to cancel all school exams. School kids can be seen dancing in the streets from the space station. Here's a permanent reminder of a temporary feeling. 10 years ago, a woman in England met a guy on spring break. He offered to pay for her to get a tattoo of his name on her butt. The very next morning, she woke up to the name Daniel Ford tattooed on her hinder. Fast forward 10 years, and now she's wanting to get in touch with Daniel. It would have been so much easier if Daniel just spent a few extra bucks and had his phone number tattooed on the other cheek. How about this? Afghanistan's former finance minister is now an Uber driver in Washington, D.C. As any musician will tell you, hey, a gig's a gig. And finally, in the gated community of Aki Harbor, Virginia, security rolled up on a naked man who was high and directing traffic. But because he was doing such a good job and for free, they didn't give him a ticket. But they did give him a ride home. Isn't that nice? On the podcast today, we have Dave Sandstrom, Chris Evers, Kendall Bauer, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Titting.
Well, thanks, Max. Maybe not a lot of opportunities to pick up that $5 million looking out over the Milwaukee River and Lake Michigan right now, not seeing too many Russian yachts out there today. But, maybe they find a way to get out of the lake here if they're trying to hide. But maybe a little bit of benefit from the markets this week, depending on how you were invested. The NASDAQ up 2% this week, closing today at 14,169. The S&P up 1.8% this week, closing today at the bell at 45,43. The Dow Jones Industrial Average added 154 points today, closing the week up 107, up 0.3% at 34,862. For the year, the NASDAQ still down 9.3%, the Dow down just 3.6%, and the broader S&P down 4.4% for the year, including dividends. It's a quick look at the performance for the week. You know, Kendall, we've strung together now two consecutive positive weeks for investors in the span of 13 trading days, up from really the bottom of what was the worst of the selling, nearly 8.5% for the S&P. I think a stark reminder for investors just how quickly things can turn. And certainly that doesn't mean that all of the pain is over or that everything's behind us. But I think it is a reminder that, trying to time the markets can, maybe leave you missing out on some of the best days.
Yeah, that's led to a lot of important conversations about exactly that. You know, trying to time the market in the short term is near impossible. And, the market gets a little bit of data here that they look fondly on in the long term. And, you can have weeks like last week and this week where it comes firing back. And, if you're someone that tries to get out at the bottom and, play that game of jumping back in and out, you can, really get beat up. So it's just another reminder about why it's so important to stay diversified, balanced. Keep an eye on your growth and value stock, your allocation stock to bonds. Stay relatively balanced. And for a lot of clients or investors, a 60-40 stock to bond mix, it's going to alleviate some of the volatility and, stay the course and try not to play that game because you can end up in rough shape if you're jumping in and out.
Yeah, I think it's about being humble, right, and understanding that even when all the data is going your way, sometimes you can be wrong about the way the market takes that. Even when all the data is working against you, sometimes you can be wrong about the way the market takes that. And so we're still a couple of weeks away from earnings season where we'll have some better data on kind of what the first quarter looked like. Still a couple of weeks away from having some economic data on what the first quarter looked like. And I think you know, if anything, this is just a reminder that even absent some meaningful changes in kind of the outlook, you know, stocks, I think, can find some sanity. The one, I think, big shift that we've seen, especially in the last week, is just how quickly the Fed has turned a bit more hawkish. Dave, we got a report this week from Citi that their analysts see potentially 4.5 percentage point hikes this year. You know, you've got Jerome Powell and some of the other Fed members talking about, you know, maybe not quite that quickly, but, you know, still seeing 7 rate increases this year. That's a substantial move. And we've seen the rates across the bond market react, I think, pretty substantially to that.
Yeah, Kyle, it's you have to start to wonder if the Fed is maybe trying to get things to move more with their verbiage at this point, because they've taken a substantial, you know, change here in the last few months on their stance and much more hawkish view of things. And, you know, of course, the million-dollar question, or probably trillions of dollars of questions, lies in whether or not they can orchestrate a soft landing coming through this. And, you know, I think that everybody pretty much agrees that with inflation, you know, north of 7%, pushing 8%, that the Fed does need to step in. So I think you're seeing agreement there. I think the market's even cheered that on, believe it or not, a little bit the last couple of weeks. But ultimately, you look back over the last 12 times that the Fed has embarked on this, they've only been able to orchestrate that soft landing 3 times, 65, 84, and 1994 as well. And right now, I would comment that, you know, the current inflation numbers are much higher than target than they were back then, as well as we have a much tighter labor force right now. So it's going to be difficult, I think, for the Fed to navigate a soft landing this time around. But I do think that it's obviously something that we have to address with inflation at 40-year highs.
Yeah, Dave, just to piggyback on that real quick, I mean, the Fed, just with the verbiage that they've used, have tightened financial conditions without having to do a whole lot either on the balance sheet or actually raising interest rates. Yes, we did see last week that quarter point increase, but we've seen, you know, a pretty substantial move on the 10-year Treasury up to, you know, nearly 2.5%. And sizable moves on mortgage rates as well, which, you know, it does tighten financial conditions and could, you know, possibly achieve their goal of just cooling things off a little bit. So they're trying to use some of that language to tighten, you know, the financial conditions without having to make dramatic moves, you know, potentially later in the year.
And the other comment I would make, Chris, is that it's a little more interesting this time around is the rest of the world is tightening at the same time. Last time we went through this, I think a lot of central banks were actually still going in the opposite direction that the U.S. was going in. So I think that's going to has some impact on the situation. And kind of an interesting side note is, you know, we talked a lot in the past few years about negative yielding debt. And what a kind of a crazy experiment that was. I think the global negative yielding debt topped out at about $18 trillion a few years ago. It's down to 3 now. And they're estimating that if the European Central Bank raises a couple more times this year, that it might be negligible. And the world will be out of the negative category, which I think is kind of an interesting topic.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting. We had corporate bonds in the teens being issued at, you know, Nestle was able to issue at negative rates. And that was something that, you know, I think many of us couldn't even wrap our heads around at the time. How are we paying someone to hold our money for a little while to pay them back? And, you know, I think I joked on the podcast a few times about some anecdotes coming out of Japan about how there were runs on safes because people would have rather bought a safe for their house than, you know, put their money in the bank and lose money on those deposits. And so, you know, I think what's interesting to me is how we've seen this play out in the past. Chris, you mentioned earlier, right before we started recording, kind of the parallels to the taper tantrum. And I think, you know, when we look back at the, you know, mid-teens, every piece of good news that kind of signaled that maybe the Fed could take another step was kind of received as bad news by stocks. And I think, you know, we're seeing good news, at least in terms of the Fed having some cover to raise rates. And at least for now, stocks seem to be pretty encouraged by that.
Yeah, it's almost earlier this year, you know, when the market sold off in anticipation of this change by the Fed, there was almost a questioning of, is the Fed actually going to do something here? You know, we got pretty high level of inflation, and the language from the Fed had not quite yet gotten to the point of, we're going to raise rates more aggressively. And once they went forward and changed some of their language and took that first step, you know, the market the last 2 weeks has done pretty well. And I was making that connection back to 2013 during the taper tantrum, when essentially the 10-year Treasury moved from about 1.25 up to about 3% in a short period of time, when Ben Bernanke was the chair of the Fed at that time. And looking at the similarities to right now, where we've moved from about, you know, 1.25, 1.5 up to 2.5 in a pretty quick move on the 10-year Treasury. You know, obviously we're in a different inflationary environment than what we were then, potentially a different economic environment in terms of the speed of economic growth. But that reached a point where, you know, rates cooled down a little bit and Treasuries no longer climbed so high, and the economy was able to find its footing, and stocks do the same as well.
And I want to be clear that when you look at the 10-year, when you look at mortgage rates, when you look at any number of kind of longer dated rates that are out there, I think we're pricing in a lot of what the expectation is for where rates head. And so for investors looking at their bond portfolios and going, wow, I'm down, you know, what feels like a significant amount in my bond portfolio this year. Remember, of course, that a bad year for bonds, and this has been a terrible year for bonds, looks very different than a bad year for stocks. But more importantly, those higher rates are going to make their way into your bond portfolios in the form of higher yields as we go along. And so I'm encouraged by kind of the outlook for bonds, even if the path that got us here has been a little more challenging.
I can hear echoing in my head the conversation we had back in 2020 when rates dropped so low that we were saying, you know, be careful, don't forward look on these bond returns and just say we're going to get this same level of returns going forward, because what we had done is we had pulled forward future returns into 2020 when rates dropped down. And we said at that time, you know, rates will probably eventually return to a more normal level and we'll give back a little bit of these gains. So don't just straight line out and say, well, I made 7% on a bond portfolio in 2020. That's great if I could just keep doing this going forward. So good reminder of not just straight lining out each year.
Chris, with Joel out this week, he stepped in and kind of did some of the economic data for us this week. You know, I think in particular the consumer sentiment number is the one that we pay a pretty close attention to, just because it's kind of the driver of economic growth here. What did we learn this week about how consumers are feeling?
Yeah, consumers still are not feeling great. They're really looking at the inflation story. You know, it's kind of easy to understand why consumers may not feel great when you look at real personal income levels that have gone essentially negative when you, again, account for inflation. You know, consumers are looking at, you know, growing wages, but it's not keeping up with the level of inflation in the economy. There was 1/3 of consumers reported that they expect their overall financial position to worsen in the year ahead, which was the highest level ever recorded for that survey, which is an interesting dichotomy, because you look at the actual consumer balance sheet and the consumer spending currently, and it's not reflected in that data. But consumers looking forward and looking at level of inflation reported a little bit of uneasiness.
Yeah, Chris, I think you're seeing the resiliency of the consumer right now as a kind of a byproduct of the pandemic. You know, you had a couple of years of people being cooped up, had to give up their vacations, summer vacations the last couple of years. And even, you know, in the face of much higher gas prices this year and maybe even higher prices across the board in restaurants and travel, people are still making those trips. And they're just not willing to cancel 3 years in a row, I think. So it'll be interesting to see how long that resiliency lasts. You know, it may fade near the end of the year, depending on how inflation numbers actually pan out.
I'm thinking of two classic axioms in investing. One, don't fight the Fed, which we essentially talked about in the beginning of the show already, the Fed's raising rates. The second one is don't bet against the American consumer's willingness to spend. And I think both are true right now. So maybe you have a irresistible object, you know, hitting a immovable force or whatever the saying might be. But we got two big things at play right now.
Yeah, and I think the critical piece is how we come through summer and into fall right now, because I think the expectation is that things slow down early in the early part of this year, that maybe spending picks up again in summer as people feel a little more free to move about the country. And then you get into fall and we start to wonder, okay, are we really beyond kind of the worst phase of this pandemic? Can we continue to progress from a pandemic standpoint, but also have we made any progress on some of these supply chain issues? And so I think, you know, the real critical juncture isn't going to be how we transition from spring into summer, looking outside and it's just about snowing out there, maybe not quite spring yet, but spring into summer. The real transition is going to be how we go from this summer into fall. And I think that'll be the piece that really tells us where we are. That isn't to say that even if we're in a worse place than we think, that you probably need to do much about that. I think it's right to point out that the consumers have continued to spend, that things like the housing market remain very strong, even if the data isn't perfect all the time. But prices in particular are quite high. And so I'm encouraged by that. I think the challenges, you know, may still be in what comes in the next 6 months or so. Outside of the consumer stuff, Chris, anything else that jumped out to you this week from the economic front?
I'll just point out again on the labor market side, you know, we had additional information on initial unemployment claims, and we had the lowest level in 50 years of new claims for unemployment on a weekly basis, and also the lowest level in 50 years for continuing claims for unemployment insurance. So again, to point at the strength of the labor market in terms of people are out there and employed, you know, that is certainly being supported by the data that we're seeing week to week.
Yeah, and fewer people quitting and more people rejoining the workforce after taking some time off. And so perhaps some of the shortages that we've been seeing in labor will start to at least be not as big of a problem, even if the solution isn't, you know, right at hand. So I think plenty of stuff, you know, as we talk about kind of the path forward, plenty of stuff to pay attention to, plenty of reasons to be optimistic, even if, you know, there's some concerns out there. And Kendall, I think you hit the nail on the head, you know, kind of in our first, you know, few jumps into the podcast today, is it's the reason we stay balanced. It's the reason we try not to get overly confident about what we think the direction ahead is. Well, thank you all for listening. We enjoyed doing the program for you. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.